Welcome to the Lee Rayburn Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and before we get to our first guest, I'd like to share a quick story about one of my best days at Wisconsin Public Radio. It actually happened to be my first day at WPR. I was in my mid-40s. I was starting a new job. I was feeling unsure, insecure, and when they sat me at my desk, I was in a big room surrounded by producers from other shows who were younger than me and cooler than me. And right next to the right of me, there was an empty desk with an old beat up Wisconsin Public Radio hat on there. The brim had been bent like an upside down U, and I was wondering, well, who's this guy that's going to be next to me? It wasn't long before in walked Larry Mueller in his mid-70s at that time. Who, much to my surprise, started talking to me about like I'd always been there, like I was a friend of his, like he always does. And we ended up sharing stories about it was barbershop quartets that day. And each day since then with Larry Mueller was just like that day. And he was always that way, sharing stories and always interrupted by the radio show. But I want to thank Larry Mueller for making me feel comfortable and giving me one of my best days at WPR. One of the many people to thank here before we get to our guest. I want to thank Kate Archer Kent, who I started working with right out of the gate. She's the co-host of Wisconsin Today, and we worked together through COVID. And through her grace and patience, she showed me what it meant to work at Wisconsin Public Radio through some of the harder times. I got to produce for Rob Ferret, the other co-host of Wisconsin Today, and I want to thank him, too, for showing me how to work with a team and be a team leader. But also I want to thank Larry's team, who has welcomed me in and continue to work on this show. Joel Patenaude, Clara Neipert, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, our program director, Adam Friedrich. And that was the first day at Wisconsin Public Radio for me more than 7 years ago. It was one of my best days, and there have been many since then. And today, well, today is also one of my best days, and I want to thank you so much for being a part of it. So let's get to our guest and on to the show. Our first guest today is Ryan Feldman, a toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center, an emergency medicine pharmacist, and an assistant professor of pharmacy and emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also the host of the Poison Lab, a podcast where he discusses the history, science, and medical management of harmful chemicals and toxins. His latest is an investigation into what he calls the Morel Dilemma. Here's a taste.
Fatal poisoning in Montana, blamed on morel mushrooms.
Yes, those morels, the kind people hunt like treasure and fry in butter. An edible delicacy eaten for centuries, suddenly killing people? This is bizarre, and I know.
I'm a toxicologist who helps treat mushroom poisoning.
Ryan Feldman, welcome back to WPR News.
Thank you so much for having me, Lee. I'm really excited to be here, and congratulations. I am so excited for this show.
Honored to have you as our first guest today, and I want to begin with a little bit of the backstory of what happened in Bozeman in 2023 and how this came to be on your radar.
Yeah, so this was a very interesting report I saw from the CDC. Maybe to back this up a little bit, you mentioned the podcast that I have, The Poison Lab. And as part of that podcast, I started kind of a side series looking at poisoning outbreaks and trying to understand how they happened, what investigators did during the outbreak. Because I don't know if you know this, but Wisconsin, and honestly many states, has a bit of a history with mass poisoning outbreaks. They happen here as well. And I've been involved in a few of them through my role as a clinical toxicologist with the Poison Center, helping to treat patients who have kind of mysterious symptoms and we don't know what's going on yet. So I started a series called Outbreak, where I interviewed the frontline investigators who were part of that outbreak so we could learn what they did and better apply it to the next poisoning outbreak. So poisoning outbreaks have kind of always been on my radar. But then I saw this report from the CDC, and it said mass poisoning in Bozeman, Montana, linked to morel mushrooms. Now, I'll say up front, wild mushrooms that you eat raw can make you sick. Almost any of them can. You're picking something off the forest floor, you're going to have dirt and bacteria on them. And it's been kind of known in the mycology community for a long time that eating raw morel mushrooms, which it's the end of morel season right now, so a lot of people are probably pretty bummed about it. But if you ate them raw, they can make you nauseous. They might make you throw up. But deaths have never been reported in the medical literature, which made me look at this report and say, well, this is different. This would be a new phenomenon. How do they even know this was morels and not something else in the food related to this outbreak?
Well, so Ryan, this was a sushi restaurant in the middle of Montana. So your first guess as a toxicologist probably wouldn't jump to fungus.
Absolutely. Yeah. So when I say sushi and, you know, mass poisoning, everyone jumps to raw fish. I've heard, you know, insurance commercials about gas station sushi before. This is a well-known trope, right? And that is the first thing I thought of. So then I said, well, how did they rule out contaminated fish, bacteria? You know, in 2023 in Canada, there was a mass poisoning at a Asian food restaurant related to a spice that they used. And the spice came from the manufacturer. Instead of being sand ginger, it was actually a deadly poison that the manufacturer mixed in on accident. So I had all these questions. Well, how did they rule out these spices, these poisons, these bacteria that could have actually been a cause, that have caused these severe outcomes in the past, as opposed to a morel mushroom? And that's where it started. And then it started with an email to the investigators saying, hey, do you want to tell me a little bit about your story, about your investigation, so we can hear about it? And that led to interviewing not just the state and public health investigators, but also victims from this. And to give a little bit of scope, this was a mass poisoning with over 50 people involved. Two people died. I was able to speak with some family members who lost loved ones, with some victims who were poisoned. I was able to speak with the CDC investigators, the state and local public health investigators, to understand what did they test for? What was going on in their minds when they heard, hey, we have a mass poisoning and the common thread here seems to be a morel mushroom? And how they took it from there, how they kept people safe, how they investigated the restaurant, how the restaurant responded. The restaurant itself was very perplexed by this too. And they were active partners in the investigation, you know, trying to help ensure that nobody else got sick. So really getting into what it's like to be on a mass poisoning from the inside and help us all understand what silent partners kind of step in to help keep the public safe when people start dropping from mysterious illnesses. But also to help me answer the question of how are morel mushrooms suddenly killing people?
Yeah, for centuries, if cooked right, they should be okay. And worst case scenario, they might give you some indigestion or make you a little sick, but deadly? Not as far as we know, which would make you think this is not the morel mushroom. And for foragers of fungus, they would be well aware that there is also a false morel mushroom out there that could be potentially deadly.
Absolutely. So the first question, this is your, it's like you're saying the first episode right now. You know, we hear from the perspective of the patients and the investigators. And I say, well, how do we, every toxicologist I've talked to, when I bring this up, they say, and every person, they say, you know, it's been funny. I posted some clips of this on social media so people could hear about the series. And immediately, almost brigades of mycology-enthused people come in and say, well, it can't be the morel. It must have been false morels. And there are, false morel is a common name. It refers to a wide class of mushrooms that look like morels. A few of them are very poisonous and contain gyromitrin, which is a toxin that is known to cause really serious poisoning and deaths. So it would make a lot more sense that, you know, false morels getting into this food supply and then poisoning people, as opposed to, say, a true morel having the first reported deaths in the medical literature in 2023. And in fact, this is something that we explore in the show. How did they evaluate this? You know, where did the mushrooms come from? Was it a forager or were they imported? And even so, you know, in the 90s, the FDA did a study and found that something like 20% of imported morels had false morels toxicity. So it brings up all these questions of how they track and trace these different toxins and how they can rule out whether or not a false morel was involved. So episodes 2 and 3 of this series really dive into that. And I'll tell you, the CDC report does say a morel for a reason. Okay, but
yeah. Ryan Feldman, our guest, toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center, host of the Morel Dilemma podcast, chief scientist of the Poison Lab, which you can find online at thepoisonlab.com. And want to invite you into the conversation with your own questions about this investigation or your own experiences with food poisoning in Wisconsin or your own foraging experiences for safe mushrooms to eat. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, talk@WPR.org. But Ryan, your investigation quickly expanded beyond Montana. In fact, you went pretty much around the world to begin to explore how a morel mushroom could potentially be deadly when everything we've seen in the literature suggests that would not be the case.
Absolutely. So this was a bit of a scientific exploration for me. And, you know, listen, in toxicology, there's infinite poisons. And you could write a book about each one of them. So it's not unusual for me to learn something new every day. But when there's a novel phenomenon, it really makes me want to explore a little bit more. And part of this series, it's not just answering this mystery. It's also taking people into the inside of how mass poisonings are investigated. And in this series, we end up kind of coming up to the road where we've looked for all the usual suspects and even done some really sophisticated, unusual testing, and everything's coming up, you know, dry. So where do you go from that when you're trying to identify a poison? And we actually end up going to a different outbreak in France, where the rates of ALS were about 1,000 to 2,000 fold higher than in the general population. And we found out that it was being linked, after 20 years, it was being linked to eating wild mushrooms.
Huh.
And the mushrooms in play are very familiar to the ones we're talking about today. In fact, they originally thought it was linked to eating morel mushrooms.
Wow.
But then they later realized, no, it wasn't a morel. It was false morel mushrooms. So they had the same question in this series. It was like, wait, is this a morel? Is it a false morel? And we actually sit down with the investigators who spent nearly 20 years in this mountain village called Mont Chavon in France, trying to figure out what exactly was causing ALS. Now, for those who aren't familiar, ALS is a nearly universally fatal disease 3 to 5 years after diagnosis. It is truly something that needs a lot of effort into research and prevention. So these investigators did not stop when they found not just one, not just two, but 14 different cases of ALS in a town of 200, where usually the rate is 1 out of 200,000 patients, something around there. So we're way higher. And they were like, what is going on? They tested for everything. They were looking for contaminants in the soil. And it wasn't until they brought in a researcher who had cracked a case in Guam, where the rate of ALS was incredibly high. And he noticed that the chemical involved in Guam was very close to a chemical that is found in false morel mushrooms. So you got to hear it from their perspective. It's really a fascinating story. But we used their outbreak to help us understand, after no testing, they had tested for 20 years, they eventually linked this outbreak to the false morel. Well, how could we then go back to our outbreak in Bozeman and link the outbreak to a morel mushroom with all of our testing coming up dry? It's a really fascinating exploration.
And new episodes come out on Wednesdays. I believe there's a couple episodes left in the series, and I am looking forward to it very much because I've got some questions, as does our audience. So let's go to your questions next at 1-800-642-1234 for our guest, Ryan Feldman. Jack and Madison, hello.
Hello, Larry. Excuse me, Lee.
I'll take it.
Sure, and I just had to remember who I'm talking to now that you're the host.
Yeah, what do you have for us, Jack?
Yeah, Lee, so I remembered a family trip I had to Colorado a couple of years ago. We were visiting my aunt who lives in Boulder, and we were foraging for mushrooms at a forest in a Boulder County park, and I'm pretty sure they were all safe, clean, and healthy, as, of course, the plan was to put them in a pasta dish that we'd be making that night. So My question for your guest, unless you guys already talked about this, is how can you tell which mushrooms are safe and clean to eat versus those more poisonous mushrooms that may look safe, but as we all know, have very adverse effects on people health-wise?
Yeah, it's interesting because, Ryan, if you go look at a morel mushroom online and a false morel mushroom online, you'd be hard-pressed if you're not a mycologist to be able to identify the differences.
Right. So this is a great question. So yeah, beyond all this, I'll just point out, I'm maybe the nerdiest toxicologist in our state about mushrooms. I did write a children's book about safe foraging practices, and I have kind of a poisonous mushroom card game. So I spend a lot of time teaching and looking into mushroom poisoning. Here's the rule. There is no such thing as a poisonous looking mushroom. They can look almost identical to edible mushrooms. So the only way to know for sure is to be informed and learn from an authoritative guide, which if you know about Wisconsin Mycological Society, they put on fantastic mushroom certification ID courses. And as I say in my children's book, if you're foraging without authority, safety is the top priority. If you're unsure, let it be, because not every shroom is lunch, you see. It is impossible to tell with some of these. There's actually a huge outbreak right now, and I encourage everyone to do this. Google a death cap mushroom and Google, it's called a Amanita vernica. It's called the spring Amanita, okay? One of these is edible. One of them is deadly. They are indistinguishable to 99% of people. And right now in California, there is an outbreak going on where there have been 4 deaths and 4 liver transplants. Oof. Related to misforaging those spring Amanitas and accidentally getting death caps. So there really is no way to know. There's nothing that looks poisonous. You just need to know the features and have some training in actually identifying them. Now, Wisconsin Mycological Society has great resources for that. There's other local mushroom clubs that have good resources for it. As far as a morel and a false morel, there are some easy clues once you know what you're looking for. For example, if you cut a false morel in half, its stem will be thick all the way through, its stipe, versus a morel, when you cut it in half, it should be hollow. A morel has actually pits and ridges on the cap. It's called an ascomycetes, which means a cup fungus. So it kind of looks like you glued a bunch of misshapen cups together versus a false morel, which around here is generally, you know, there's a couple of genuses of false morel, but they all have wrinkly.
Oh, I think we just lost you there for a second, Ryan. Let me reset and let folks know that they can find out.
Gyromitra, that was the genus.
There you go. Sorry, we'd lost connection with you for a second there, Ryan. I think you were cutting out.
Sorry.
No, right around when you were cutting the morels and false morels in half, and the false morels had the stem all the way through. You're talking about the little misshapen cups and how you can tell the difference. But I would imagine that without certification and help from the Wisconsin Mycological Society, that you probably should leave it to the experts.
Absolutely. If you're not sure, the rule of thumb is if you don't know if you can eat it, you can't eat it.
It's a good rule of thumb. But you talk about these outbreaks, and when we hear them in the news, we hear them in terms of the statistics. And one of the things you do in The Moral Dilemma is take us into the actual impacts on families that these deaths are. We meet the family of one of the persons who died from this outbreak in 2023 in Bozeman, Montana. We meet their family. We hear about who they are, and this becomes very real in the way you expand that to when you were talking about the outbreak of the death cap in California with 4 dead. That's not just 4 lives lost. That's any number of, you know, lives impacted tragically.
Absolutely. That was a really important part for me in this series. This is a bit of a different series. Oftentimes when I talk with investigators in some of my other outbreak series, it's a little more cold and clinical, where we're just talking about how they went through things, how they investigated. But as someone who myself, I see the impacts of these mass poisonings in patients that I interact with. It's not just a statistic. These people are sometimes, their lives are altered forever. And I think that's so important for people to understand. It's, you know, not just a news story, it's someone's life. So I wanted to make sure if I was telling this story, I was including the story of the victims and those who are surviving and carrying on the memory of some victims. And it's important for us to recognize that that is why we need good public health infrastructure in order to be able to respond to and prevent these types of outbreaks because of the real human costs on the other side. So people will hear from the Ventura family who lost a wife and mother in this outbreak. They'll hear from some who were others who were poisoned. And I think it's really important to help us all understand the real human costs when we don't have safeguards in place. In truth, this poisoning outbreak is small in terms of some of the other ones we've had just here in the United States that have led to hundreds of deaths. And those deaths ripple outward into communities where caregivers are lost, loved ones are lost, and they leave lasting impacts really forever. So it's important we understand that.
What should somebody do if they think they've eaten a poisonous mushroom, or if, you know, a little bit after a meal, they start to feel that discomfort and they know what's coming? What does a toxicologist say about how they should act next?
Well, this is a really easy question, Lee. In fact, I could cite my children's book again.
It's for all ages then, Ryan.
It really is. It really is. If you ate a shroom you're not sure about, a poison center will help you out. So don't fret. You're not alone. You only need to pick up the phone. The help is free. The expert's true. They'll know what's best to do. You just call 1-800-222-1222. And really, every day, every other day from May through October, we get a call at the poison center about someone who maybe ate a mushroom they're now concerned is poisonous, or developed some symptoms after eating something. And we are there to help with actual trained experts in managing mushroom poisoning, not the opinions you'll find on the internet. we will there for free help you manage what is kind of a unique and rare poisoning. So please give us a call, because we deal with this all the time. And and even if you're not a forager, statistically, your toddler or your pet is.
Yes.
They get into this all the time. So we are ready to train. We have mushrooms that range just from nausea and vomiting all the way to death here in Wisconsin. So we've had a few foraging deaths. It's important to give us a call so we can help figure out which one of those we're dealing with and get you linked up with healthcare if we need to.
We can find more about that on our webpage at wpr.org/Lee now, L-E-E. But I thought maybe you could do the jingle for us again, Ryan, because it's so clever.
Okay. Well, I got to remember. So if you ate a shroom you're not sure about, a poison center will help you out. So don't fret. You're not alone. You only need to pick up the phone. The help is free. The expert's true. They'll know what's best to do. You just call 1-800-222-1222.
I love that very much. And that's part of your children's book, which you can find online at thepoisonlab.com. And we've got about a minute here, but I want to know a little bit more about this card game that you've got available as well.
The card game was a bit of an educational tool I designed to help train medical professionals about mushroom poisoning. Because a lot of times medical professionals learn what the poisoning looks like, but not the mushroom. So it combines all those features, but it actually ends up just being a fun game that really anyone could play. I've had my parents, my wife knows nothing about mushroom poisoning. She plays it all the time. And you can learn more about it at www.gottapickem.com for all the rules and a breakdown of the game and what it is.
Gotta Pick'em, the card game. And what's the children's book called, Ryan?
Poisonous Fungus Among Us. One word.
Poisonous Fungus Among Us. Our guest, Ryan Feldman, toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center, emergency medicine pharmacist, assistant professor of pharmacy and emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin, chief scientist for the Poison Lab online at thepoisonlab.com, and host of their most recent investigation, the Morel Dilemma podcast, whose next episode comes out on Wednesday. And again, links for all this can be found along with the 1-800 number and our website at wpr.org/Lee. But we've got more to this story of the outbreak in Bozeman, Montana in 2023 that left two dead, and the investigation that sent Ryan Feldman around the world and back again. We'll find out what he learned when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Lee Rayburn Show on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn. You're listening to The Lee Rayburn Show, and our guest is Ryan Feldman, a toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center, an emergency medicine pharmacist, and an assistant professor of pharmacy and emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Also host of The Poison Lab online at thepoisonlab.com, a podcast discussing the history, science, and medical management of harmful chemicals and toxins. And if you've got questions for our expert, you're welcome to the show. If you've got horror stories about food poisoning or want to know how to best forage in Wisconsin safely, join us at 1-800-642-1234. Or questions about this outbreak that happened at a sushi restaurant in Bozeman, Montana in 2023 that left two dead, and its lead suspect was the morel mushroom, which cooked correctly should not have killed anybody. So what questions do you have for Ryan? 1-800-642-1234 or email us talk@wpr.org. And before we get back to the rest of your story here, Ryan, with two episodes left and they come out on Wednesdays, I want to ask you how doctors best treat poisoning when it comes into the emergency room, what they do when somebody's ingested a potential poisonous mushroom. What is the treatment there?
That's a really great question. There's not necessarily one treatment, because if we think about that, you know, there's infinite poisons. They can have different. Well, here's the gist of it. There are infinite poisons. There really are only 50 antidotes. So 99.9% of poisoning cases are surrounding providing what we call good supportive care. If somebody isn't able to breathe, we breathe for them. If their blood pressure is low, we use medications to bring the blood pressure up. As far as reversing the effects of a specific poison, well, if it happens to be one of them that responds to these 50 or so antidotes, we can definitely do that. That's really where the, you know, the science and milieu comes in of, you know, who needs an antidote and when do we use it? Then other things we do are try to clean the blood of poison, things like dialysis, where we kind of actually pull stuff out of the blood or do blood exchanges. These are kind of more rare to do what we call a transfusion exchange, but sometimes we use that. And then, you know, we actually kind of have a paradigm. It's called ABCDEFG. So ABCs are airway, breathing, circulation. E is enhancing the elimination of the drug, if you can, or the poison. I skipped D, which is decontaminate. So get the poison off the patient. The solution to pollution is dilution, as they say. And G is get help, or F is focused antidote, which is, you know, give an antidote. And G is get help from a toxicologist, because we are available at the Poison Center 24 hours a day, not just to the public, but also to treating hospitals. So if a hospital or a provider is treating someone who's been poisoned, they might have been trained on, you know, 1 or 2% of the poisons out there. But as I said, you know, there's nothing that's not poison. It's the dose that makes the poison. So if there's a unique or unusual poison, like mushroom poisoning, they will usually give us a call at the Poison Center, and we will advise them on how long to monitor, what treatments to do, what labs to do, and, you know, the likely trajectory of the course.
There's nothing that's not a poison. It's the dose that makes the poison.
That is Paracelsus. He was like a 1500s physician, and that was his original. You've probably heard the term, the dose makes the poison. But, you know, what water is poisonous if you drink too much water, right? You know, everything can be a poison if you take it in an amount that overwhelms your natural biologic system's ability to process it. And that is true. It's really, that's why there are infinite poisons.
I actually worked with a guy in radio some jobs back who was part of a radio contest about who could drink the most amount of water that ended up in a fatality.
That is a really famous case that gets brought up in toxicology circles, and it's more common than you think. It wasn't just the radio, but that's a really famous one. And yeah, people don't recognize that absolutely anything can be a poison. It is only the dose that determines what is a poison and what is a medicine sometimes.
So the Morel Dilemmas episode 6 comes out on Wednesday. I am 5 episodes in, and where I'm at right now, Ryan Feldman, is that when you go back to this case in 2023 in Bozeman, Montana, in the sushi restaurant, where experts quickly began to identify the morel mushroom as a possible suspect, what you find is that not everybody who ate the morel got sick, and not everybody who got sick ate the morel, which to me means we're back to square one, but to you sort of led you on a different path altogether.
Right. So that is not an uncommon finding in some of these outbreaks, especially when it's related to a new substance that we've not really seen before. And I love that you bring this up. It's really so part of this whole series is to help people understand how we deal with poisoning outbreaks. And you might know of another outbreak called, well, you might know of it. This was back in 2019. It was called e-cigarette and vape-associated lung injury, or EVALI. Teenagers all over the United States were winding up needing things like lung transplants from using vapes. And we had no idea why. These are really young people getting really sick from vapes. We don't know what's in the vape. We don't know what vapes are impacted. But this was an example of a mass poisoning outbreak, which, by the way, Wisconsin was, site zero for that. We actually identified the first patients here in Wisconsin. So I was actually involved in that outbreak doing a little bit of research trying to figure out what could be the cause. And we also ran into a problem where, hey, we kind of landed quickly in that outbreak on a substance called vitamin E acetate, which is something that is used in only THC vapes. And when you vaporize it, it can turn into a toxic product called ketene that pretty much destroys the lungs. Now, we were like, okay, well, we see that, but then why do we have all these other cases from nicotine vapes that wouldn't have vitamin E acetate in it? And it's because as a new syndrome, we didn't know who could be impacted or even what the syndrome really looked like. We knew what the worst of it looked like. It was kids needing lung transplants. But what about the people who were only a little bit less sick? So when counting cases, the CDC said, well, anyone who's used a vape in the last 90 days and has any lung symptoms without any viral infection, that's a case of EVALI. So we ended up over-including patients in this outbreak because we didn't want to miss any of the real ones, and we didn't really know what it looked like, right? Imagine I say, hey, there's a new poison on the street and people are dropping dead. We don't know what it is and we don't know what it could look like, right? You're gonna just count anyone who says they have symptoms and an appropriate history. So you end up over-including people. And we talk about this in episode 5. Something like that probably happened here in Bozeman too, because we've never seen morels cause deaths before, so we didn't really know what the full toxicity could look like. So they included a really wide range of people. And some of those people might not have actually been morel poisoning. It might have been some background illness. And we dive into this in episode 5. It's really, if you're really a big data nerd, you're going to love that episode. but there's even more to it. So then, like, why do so many people why did some people eat the morels and not get sick?
Yes.
That's the big question. And, nothing in this investigation is necessarily me revealing new insider information. You're more hearing it from the perspective of the investigators. This is already out there, and you could read the CDC report to learn more. But a big part of it ended up having to do with preparation of the morels, which I'll let people learn more about it. I don't want to give it away if you want to hear the story, because it is a story, right? But let's put it this way. We've long known morels being served, eaten raw could make people vomit, right? And that could absolutely be a part of this investigation. One of the reasons why some people got sick, maybe their morels were undercooked. But it doesn't answer the question of, well, why after 2,000 years are we now seeing our first deaths from this? Assuming we've been eating morels for they've been able to make people sick forever.
And we've long known that cooking them is the way to make them a delicacy.
Right. So then why am I now, it's not like this would be the first time ever people have eaten raw morels. So why am I suddenly seeing such severe poisoning from this?
Well, and then I start thinking, Ryan, are mushrooms evolving? Are they changing the way their genetic makeup somehow? And when you start to look at this question, it takes you down a strange path towards the magic mushroom, otherwise known as psilocybin, which I found to be an incredible tangent until you start to realize that there are stories about psilocybin making people sick in ways that would probably make anybody think twice before ingesting it.
Yeah. So these are all the things we start to explore. Well, hey, are mushrooms changing? And it turns out there's a few other cases of mushrooms that have been eaten or taken forever suddenly developing, or at least us suddenly identifying, a new toxicity with them. And one of them, like you said, is the magic mushroom, or psilocybe genus mushrooms. I know it sounds weird. That is how it's pronounced, psilocybe, not psilocybe. For the mushroom, it is called psilocybin, the drug inside of it. But there are several species of psilocybe mushroom that we are now finding are causing extreme weakness and up to the point of what we call paralysis, but you can't move your muscles after you ingest them, to the point where some people need breathing tubes.
Oh,
even being a death associated with it. And this has been identified, probably the earliest case was back in the 70s, but now we're seeing, or at least identifying, a much higher frequency of it. So I actually, in this series, talked to the researchers who helped identify the signal of what we call wood lover's paralysis, which is weakness and paralysis from psilocybin mushrooms, and specifically ones that, as you can guess, love to grow on wood. And so there's this question of, okay, is it something that's in the wood? But that doesn't seem to be the case, because they grow on all sorts of different types of wood. And the best theory we have, as we get into with some of the researchers and some of the people who have treated these patients who developed this weakness, is that they may have mutated and are now producing a compound at a really high concentration that they weren't producing, at least at this concentration before. And that compound, it's called 4-hydroxytrimethyltryptamine, but it is related to a compound we know can cause paralysis. So there's a really good theory here that, hey, a small genetic change leads to a big change in the amount of a certain compound that's produced. And now we're seeing the clinical effects in humans.
But Ryan, let me challenge that a little bit, because you said that there are some examples that may go back to the 1970s of these types of cases. And although we've seen more recently, we've seen more investigations into the study of psilocybin mushrooms. I think that's even happening here at the UW campus to some degree. We've seen an increase in demand or supply or use of these mushrooms. So maybe it's not that they're evolving so much as that we're seeing more of them because people are taking more of them.
Absolutely. So overall, the whole, you know, what's going on with new toxicities mm-hmm. in mushrooms, I do think there's an interplay of, you know, mushrooms are having a moment right now, and it seems more people than ever are eating them. So maybe we're just seeing different cases now that we're exposing mushrooms to a way bigger variety of people. Now, we explore that in the series for morels too, although I don't think this is the first time morels have come across, you know, a particularly vulnerable population. They've been loved for centuries. So I would be surprised to find out that's why we're seeing these severe toxicities. But maybe. But for psilocybin specifically, it's only 6 species of these mushrooms, of about 200 species, that are repeatedly causing this paralysis, which really gives some ground for this being more of a genetic mutation, because there's some really interesting data about that specific species having more mutations than other given species. And there's some really interesting groundwork about the compounds that they produce. So it could be, in part, we're identifying the signal more because more people are taking this stuff. You bring up UW-Madison, which I really appreciate. My old pharmacy school professor, Dr. Paul Hudson, brings people down into the basement of the pharmacy school and gives them psilocybin. It's really fun to hear about. And actually, we did a whole podcast episode on the Poison Lab called "The Poison Lab Does Psilocybin." Yes, it was being... It was being cheeky, but feel free to check that out if you want to learn more about the psilocybin research that's going on there. But I agree, we don't know yet what the actual cause is, and those are all the things we explore in this series.
With infinite poisons, and it's everything's poisonous, it's just a matter of the dose, it seems to make your job exponentially more difficult, Ryan Feldman, as a toxicologist, and nailing down what is making people sick and potentially dying, seeming like a little bit of a needle in a haystack. And one of the tools you have to work with is the medical journals that have come before you, the research that has come before you. But when you're dealing with the potential of a new poison, it's almost like it feels like you're kind of shooting in the dark or looking everywhere for something that might just be in a few places around the world.
Absolutely. So, you know, we try very hard in the scientific community to use very objective, transparent data. But it turns out that's not always there. Hmm. You know, as someone who deals with novel emerging substances a lot, I can't tell you the kind of wacky things people buy online, research chemicals that they're trying. You know, sometimes I am in the dark and I have to go to places like drug user message boards to find out, hey, what is this drug someone's reporting taking? And what does it do? And sometimes we get our signal data there, but we try to use as much objective scientific literature as we can when somebody's life or limb is on the line, right? And for Morels, there have never been a published case of death from Morels. And actually, if you really look, there's not much in the medical literature about them making you sick when you eat them raw. There are some anecdotal cases in mycology communities and online posts, but that's hardly the kind of objective evidence you really want to rely on. And this outbreak in Bozeman, this CDC report, happened to be a little bit of a flare signal, I would say, that caused a lot of other people to start going back and looking through their data. And it was actually the impetus of discovering a number of other, which a lot of people are going to learn about in episode 6 that's releasing this week, of serious mushroom poisoning events that are related to Morels. So I'll just pull the carpet out right there. And we're learning a lot more about maybe what was under the surface this whole time. And we just didn't have the right cue to go look for the signal.
Ryan Feldman, would you eat a meal that included cooked morel mushrooms right now?
I absolutely would, and I did last week. I got some great, I got some morels. There's a great local stand here in Milwaukee called Flush with Mush, and they were selling some morels, and I bought them, and it was great. Also,
see, that's reassuring.
Yes, yes. So cooking is a really important part of it, but then how much do you cook them? Mm-hmm. What's cooked enough? Nobody has an answer to that. That I know of, and I've talked to the CDC and several mycologists about this. The FDA has a website that simply says eating wild mushrooms should be done at your own risk. cooking reduces the risk, but we don't know how much. And unfortunately, when you look at a lot of these things, some heat has been applied to a number of these mushrooms, but they still made people sick. You know, so the question of how much cooking is something we really need to look into in research. But probably have to start with, hey, what am I cooking out of this thing in the first place? Is it a bacteria? Is it a poison? Is it something that is on the morel or in the morel? And I do get into that with some scientists who are trying to look for that answer in episode 6.
Ryan Feldman, toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Lab, chief scientist of the, toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Lab, host of the Poison Lab online at thepoisonlab.com. The next episode of the Morel Dilemma comes out on Wednesday, and you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Have a couple emails here for you, Ryan. Matt emailed. He says, he tells people on hikes, you don't have to eat mushrooms to enjoy them. Matt considers mushrooms to be like wildflowers. He says, asks, is there something that just gives a person the drive to eat mushrooms, even though logic dictates otherwise? And we see this in dogs and we see this in kids. And I'm wondering, Matt wonders, is there something that compels us to taste them?
Well, I think from an evolutionary psychology perspective, exploring various food sources is probably rewarded over time. And if you actually do, if you do the math on it, here's the thing. We have about somewhere between 50 and 200,000 known mushrooms, right? Only about 200 of those mushrooms are known to be poisonous. Hmm. So that's like 0.1% of the known mushrooms that are out there. So your actual odds of picking a poisonous mushroom are pretty low, but they're not zero. And unfortunately, there are deaths every single year and poisonings every single year. The real problem is a lot of people don't have access to the historical knowledge that has taught us about what is poisonous or not. And they go out there making an uninformed decision. And it doesn't harm them enough to dissuade, you know, oftentimes you will be okay. But if you happen to pick the funeral bell, it might be the last mushroom you eat. So you got to be careful. I understand why, without any information about these things can be poisonous, why people would do it, because it's just stuff out there. I chase my daughter down the driveway and grab 4 leaves out of her mouth. I get it. Kids like to stuff in their mouth too. It happens. It's kind of a human thing, but it's really good for people to be aware. there are some pretty dangerous ones out there. So please, sometimes the best thing you can do is just appreciate the beauty of the mushroom on the ground.
Vicky emailed us. Her sister in California and her husband ate at a restaurant. Later, she started having hallucinations. She knew they were happening because she knew there was not a cougar at the end of her bed. By process of elimination, they and the doctor realized she had a dish that contained mushrooms that her husband had not eaten. Vicky guesses her sister did not actually have to have any treatment other than observation and time. I don't know what that mushroom would have been, but I imagine I'd like to avoid it at the restaurant.
I think I would like to avoid it too.
The one that comes with cougars at the end of your bed.
There are several hallucinatory mushrooms. I wouldn't opine to know, you know, what this one was specifically, but I can tell you there are several hallucinatory mushrooms. Psilocybin is one that everybody pretty much knows about. There's another one that's gaining a lot of interest in Asia right now. I think a lot of people have seen the news stories about it. It is, we believe, and I don't want to misspeak, I do believe it's a type of bolete mushroom, but it, which is a type that has kind of pores underneath instead of gills, but it is a, has been causing hallucinations of little people. They're called Lilliputian hallucinations. And everybody, a lot of people are talking about this right now, mainly because we don't know what's in it that's causing these hallucinations. It does seem to be a consistent observation reported by multiple users. More and more scientific research is starting to get into this. There's some questions as to if there's like a compound similar to Benadryl in there, which can sometimes cause similar types of hallucinations. I'm sorry, Vicky, about your sister. I'm glad to hear she's okay. And you do have to be careful, especially if mushrooms are sourced from maybe a not a certified forager. For example, in Wisconsin, we have a wild mushroom identification certification you could take through Mycological Society. You just want to be careful. I personally, you know, one of my favorite restaurants is one down here in Milwaukee called Morel, and I eat mushrooms all the time. I don't worry too much, but it is good to know there are dangerous ones out there.
With a few minutes we have left here, Ryan, what are your hopes about people taking what they will take away from a moral dilemma, and what do you hope they get from this?
So this is the story of an outbreak. It's supposed to be educational. It's also supposed to bring you in to what it's like when one of these outbreaks happens. Who steps in? Who gets involved to help prevent others from getting sick? What is it like to be a victim and not have answers to what is causing this illness? And what types of infrastructure do we need to support here in the US to ensure we're not going to have events like this happen in the future? So along the way, you're going to learn, you know, what, there's bonus episodes about what poison centers do. There's bonus episodes about investigations the CDC has been involved in and what role they played with CDC investigators. There's bonus episodes about who identifies mushrooms during mushroom poisoning events, and bonus episodes about specific mushroom poisons. So if you are in any way interested in medical mysteries or documentary style storytelling, this is going to be something I think you'll find a lot of value in. It is entertaining, but it is really there as educational. And I wanted to bring as many people in as I could. So I worked very hard to make sure it is an enjoyable listen to in terms of keeping you engaged in the process of what we go through when people suddenly start developing mysterious symptoms and we don't know what the cause is.
I'm very much looking forward to Wednesday and the next episode. But one of the takeaways is a strong public health sector and something that is available for everybody when and if they need medical attention and help.
Absolutely. I want people to also recognize this phenomenon with the morel is not well known. And I want people to know there might be more at the end of your fork than just a delicious meal. If you are eating morels, you need to be aware of the risks associated with them, and they need to be cooked well, okay? Because we don't want any more serious health effects from something like this.
And that's coming from the toxicologist who regularly dines at the Morel in Milwaukee. Ryan Feldman, thank you so much for joining us today. Looking forward to catching up with your next investigation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And remember, you can find the card game and the children's book and the Morel Dilemma podcast online at thepoisonlab.com. Ryan Feldman, toxicologist with the Wisconsin Poison Center, chief scientist at the Poison Lab, assistant professor of pharmacy and emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Lee Rayburn Show.